Good afternoon. Just wait for this to come up. There we go. Okay, my name is Andy Zuckerberg, and I'm going to be talking about providing an overview of disability data that we collect at the Department of Education with a focus on the National Center for Education Statistics, which is where most of our data collection takes place. And I've got a handout up here which has details on all the surveys that I'll be talking about, a lot more detail, sample sizes, resources for the for accessing the data, and other information and contacts, and some definitions as well. So feel free to grab one at the end of the presentation. Great. So no relationships to disclose there, and just a little bit of an overview of the talk. I'm going to go through the goals for the talk, the legislation that affects our data collections, some of our administrative data collection, our survey collections and assessments, and then just some conclusions on issues that we run into in collecting this data. So the goal is to become familiar with the disability data available from the Department of Education and to see examples of analysis using the ED data, and then learning how to get access to the data and support. And primarily those last two items will be in the slides, in the handouts rather, some more details on the data and where to get it. The primary source of our data collection on disability is through the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, and or IDEA. IDEA is the law that ensures services to children with disabilities, and it governs how the states and public agencies provide early intervention, special education, and related services. And currently, about 6.5 million eligible infants, toddlers, and children, youth with disabilities receive services under IDEA. It's divided into two parts. Infants and toddlers are considered under Part C, and youth or children aged 3 to 21 are under Part B. And this somewhat guides some of the data collections that we do, these separate parts and these categories for the ages. So IDEA has a definition of disability, and it includes the following areas: intellectual disability, which was previously referred to as mental retardation, hearing impairments, including deafness, speech or language impairments, visual impairments, including blindness, serious emotional disturbance, orthopedic impairments, autism, traumatic brain injury, other health impairments, specific learning disabilities, and developmental delay. And that other health impairments includes other limitations like asthma, ADD, ADHD, that are interfering with the child's ability to learn. So it's centered around the child's ability to learn for all these. And the IDEA legislation requires that states that receive funds, which is all the states, report back to the government on how the services that they're providing and different characteristics of the children who are receiving the services, such as their age, gender, race, ethnicity, their limited English proficiency status, the disability itself, and again, using those categories that I mentioned before. The educational environment, which is basically if the child's receiving services or is learning in a regular classroom or inside a special classroom or in a special school. Discipline issues, exiting from special education, so if the children are graduating high school or dropping out or otherwise no longer receiving special education services. And then any dispute resolution with the parents or caregivers related to the child's disability and their individualized education plan. It also requires that the states report on the teachers who are providing or the professionals who are providing services to the children and whether the children are participating in state assessments or not and how they're performing on those assessments. So within that framework, this sort of guides a lot of our data collection. And we can see this is the 2009 reporting. Specific learning disability was the largest category that states reported children receiving or states had classified children in. And it was followed by speech or language impairment. And then the other health impairment category was the next largest. And I mentioned before the educational environment was an important topic for the department. And what we see here is that most of the children are receiving their education inside of a regular classroom for 80% or more of the day, and then goes down from there. So in terms of collecting this data, some of the challenges are that states, the law allows the states to define the eligibility for the disability their own way. So a child who's classified as autistic in one state may fall under developmental delay or another condition in another state, depending on how that state does it, or may not be eligible. They may not meet that another state's requirements for eligibility. So there's some inconsistencies in how the states classify children and determine eligibility, and that leads to some inconsistent reporting of the disabilities. Also, there are some issues with the accuracy and completeness of reports. Although these are mandatory collections, school and district resources can determine how the data, how accurate the data is and how complete it is when it's sent back to the department. And for example, urban areas, large school districts tend to have coordinators or people who are specially assigned and their job is to collect and report on this data. Whereas in a small rural setting, for example, it may be the school secretary or someone else who's just collecting this data, and they may not have access to all the information like discipline issues that the children are having or outcomes of mediation. So there's some inconsistencies there in the reporting. Another is, although it's a mandatory collection again, the quality of the data really varies, so we've lately been building more edit checks into the data collection tools themselves. We were seeing a lot of issues where the counts wouldn't add up, so the counts of students wouldn't add up with the counts of students by gender when you added the two genders together. So we're trying to build in more controls in the collection systems themselves to alert people to inconsistencies so those get taken care of at that level. Now I'm going to switch focus a little bit to our sample surveys and that collect data on disability. And these tend to focus on the IDEA categories because of the legislation, and that's what we anchor a lot of our collections to. So they tend to ask for diagnosed conditions, and often it's an informant reporting on behalf of the child, and I think this will probably come through in some of the other presentations as well, where the child themselves is not being screened, but you're talking to a parent or, in our case, often a school administrator, or as I mentioned before, it could be a school secretary or someone else who may or may not even know the child or know them that well, and so they're using often their own records for that information. Or in the case of the parent, they're going on information that they have. And so recently some studies have begun to integrate more functional limitations to enhance the disability, the diagnosed condition categories with other limitation categories. And I'll show some examples of questions that are being developed in a few slides. So a typical series is that would be used in some of the surveys that I'll be talking about is, has a doctor, healthcare provider, teacher, or school official ever told you that the reference child has any of the following conditions? And then it's basically the IDEA categories, specific learning disability, any developmental delay that affects their ability to learn, autism, deafness or another hearing problem, blindness or another vision impairment that cannot be corrected with glasses, an orthopedic impairment, traumatic brain injury, intellectual disability or mental retardation, attention deficit disorder, attention deficit hyperactive disorder, or another health impairment lasting 6 months or more. So this is, if you pull any of the different data collections, you'll usually see a series like this in there. And it would vary if it's the school reporting, then they would just be checking off boxes about each of the children in the school. For a parent, it's set up this way. The first study that I'm going to talk about, the first couple actually, are longitudinal studies that were designed specifically to look at special education services. And this first one was the pre-elementary education longitudinal study. It looks at the characteristics of children receiving preschool special education and the programs and services they receive. And because it's longitudinal, it allows us to see the transition between early intervention and preschool and between preschool and elementary school. And it also had some assessment components in it, so it allowed us to test the individual children who are receiving services and look at their progress on testing, standardized testing over time. So some interesting data points just to give you some examples of the kinds of things that we collect and how the data can be used. For children who were receiving special education services in kindergarten, so remember they were identified at pre-kindergarten and were still receiving services in kindergarten, 73% of the teachers indicated that the regular education classroom was the main education setting for the child. So we see, again, we're looking at where they're learning, if they're in a regular classroom or if they're being pulled out and treated in a special classroom. The data also showed that at age 3, children with a speech or language impairment had significantly higher mean scores on the math skills measure than children with autism or developmental delay. But then by age 10, the gap in scores for children with a speech or language impairment between children with a speech or language impairment and those with a developmental delay persisted, but children with autism caught up to children with a speech or language impairment by age 10. Another study that's longitudinal, sort of picks up after the preschool elementary, is the National Longitudinal Transition Study. And this one describes the secondary school experience and the transition into young adulthood. So it looks at adult programs, post-secondary education or employment, independence, and various social domains like community participation. And this survey showed us that 60% of adults with disabilities reported having continued on to post-secondary education within 8 years of leaving high school, and 94% of young adults with disabilities reported having been engaged in employment or post-secondary education or job training during this post-high school period. It also, because this was the second round of a survey that had been conducted before, we can compare the two cohorts, and we see that between the 2005 NLSTS2 cohort was about 20 percentage points higher in terms of the number who were in post-secondary school after high school than the 1990 cohort. So we see some gains there. The next study is the Early Childhood Longitudinal Survey, and this again is a longitudinal study. This one was not specifically designed to capture children receiving special education services, but it had an oversample of children with characteristics that are associated with the presence of a disability, such as twins born with low or very low birth rates. And it also collects a lot more detail than the standard IDEA disability categories. So it collects the specific diagnosis. If the parent told us to one of those earlier types of questions that the child had been diagnosed with something, these surveys, unlike many of the other ones, this one would go into the specific diagnosis that the child had received. It also picks up any information on medications, therapy that the child's receiving. And then it collects information on their functional issues, such as thinking or solving problems, paying attention, coordination, and independence. And some interesting data points from here. 13% of parents of kindergarten children report their children encountered difficulties paying attention. And it varied by the child's sex, mother's education, welfare receipt, and race ethnicity. Another interesting point was that the percentage of students receiving special education grew from 4.1% in kindergarten to almost 12% by the time the students were in fifth grade. And higher percentages of boys than girls and of poor students than non-poor students received special education. These are our post-secondary data collections, and I've kind of summarized them here. I have a lot more detail in the handouts. But they also collect the standard IDEA disability categories. And they collect information also on mobility impairments. Specifically, some data points here amongst 2003-2004 first-time student post-secondary students, 10% reported a disability, and of those with a disability, 40% completed a certificate or degree within 6 years of entering college, compared to 51% of respondents who did not report a disability. Among the 2007-2008 bachelor's degree recipients, about 8% reported a disability. And of those, 48% were working full-time in one job 1 year after completing their bachelor's degree, compared to the 7% of respondents who did not report a disability. The next survey is the National Household Education Survey, and this is a cross-sectional one. So it's conducted every couple of years, but not with the same group of children. And it includes data that's not data about students who are not in a traditional school, for example, homeschooled children. In addition to collecting the standard IDEA categories, it collects information on individualized education programs and other services that the child's receiving at the school. And for this study, we looked back at our administrative data collections, that IDEA data collections that the states report on children receiving services. And the nice thing was that we saw no detectable differences when looking at the estimates of children receiving services from the household study to the administrative data collection. So that was a good check on the data there for that one. In the NHES, we also learned that among children that were homeschooled, 11% of parents reported that the child's physical or mental health problem was a factor in their decision to homeschool. And another 21% reported that the child's other special needs were a reason in their decision to homeschool the child. Some other interesting NHES data points. We've been testing, I mentioned before that, and you may be familiar with Rose's Law, which made the change in government statistics referring to mental retardation as intellectual disability. We recently conducted a split panel test where we tested one questionnaire that used mental retardation and another that used the term intellectual disability. And the preliminary data looks like we had much higher reporting of intellectual disability than mental retardation. And when we looked at what parents reported with intellectual disability, they tended to report developmental delays and ADD, but those who were responding to the mental retardation category didn't indicate that the child also had those other conditions. So it leads us to believe that parents may not yet be familiar with the change in terminology. So although we're moving to it, they may not be. So I'm going to skip ahead a little bit because time is running out. This is a collection. So in addition to collecting data from undergraduate schools, from schools, from K through 12 schools and from parents. We also collect data from universities. So here's a little bit of data on the universities, and there's some more specifics in the handout. So just to get into the data collection issues themselves, the informant's knowledge is a big issue. As I mentioned before, when we're talking to schools for our mandatory administrative collections, there are issues. So when it gets into some of these voluntary collections, there are even more issues in some cases with the reporting and their commitment to and motivation to report all the data and sort of fully for the children. And the household informant may not be aware of all the diagnosed conditions, and the parent informant may be aware of conditions that have not yet been diagnosed. So sometimes we'll see what appears to be over-reporting from the parents, where we're getting higher levels of conditions than we think are actually out there. But it may just be that the parents haven't yet, the child hasn't yet been diagnosed, but the parent's aware of the condition. And within these data collections, often our, because of the size of our samples, we can only report a single disability, so the presence of a disability, rather than breaking down the individual types of disabilities that children may have. And I'll stop there. Thank you.